Guru Nation, welcome to episode 868 of Random Musings from the Clinical Trials Guru. In this episode, I go solo and discuss your site's reputation and your reputation from all stakeholders, the public, meaning patients, sponsors, monitors, internally, such as your own employees and your PIs and the community at large. So there's a lot to unpack here. And I think I did a relatively thorough job. Of course, this is a really complex topic that needs a lot more discussion, but I tried to highlight the parts that I thought were most important. And this is going to be a topic of discussion at Save Our Sites Conference in 2025. SaveOurSites.com. If you did not register, what are you waiting for? Are you just waiting for tickets to go up? Like, the longer you wait, the higher the prices get. That's the way the pricing works. This is still early bird pricing. Make sure you register a room at the Omni Hotel, too, in Oklahoma City, 2025, March 2025. SaveOurSites.com for full details. Really quick shout out to our sponsors, Inado. The last five studies I got for my site were from Inado. Inado is a free place to get studies for your site. You don't have to pay anything. They do not get involved in any aspects of your contracts or budgets. It's free. I was skeptic until I tried it. And then I'm like, you know what? This is actually pretty cool. And shout out to another sponsor of ours, Creo. Creo is Command Central Station for my site. Speaking of site reputation, it has a lot to do with us at UMass Clinical Trials and building our reputation internally. So we try to pick tools that staff like. We try to pick tools that sponsors and CRAs like, that PIs like. Just makes us more efficient. I think Creo is amazing. Only pay for what you use. eSource, eReg, CTMS, patient recruitment portal. There's so much more. Again, only pay for what you use. Check it out. Thanks to our sponsors and enjoy this episode. Guru Nation, thank you so much for watching. Make sure you like, subscribe, comment, share, or listening if you're on the podcast. Like, look, we're creating content here. I've got in front of me because a week ago we did our Save Our Sites conference roundtable. And it's a webinar. Everybody go to our LinkedIn right now and follow Save Our Sites. And we came up with like 10 topics that we're probably going to address at the next year's Save Our Sites conference. So hello to those watching in the future. If you're watching this afterwards, don't worry, this is evergreen content. It still applies. And I've never done a video on this. I've talked around this topic, but I've never directly tackled it head on because to me it seems obvious, but I guess not. So site reputation management. What is the reputation of your site? And I'll just read like the little blurb from the article to break the ice, but maintaining a strong reputation is vital for attracting new studies and retaining staff. So a lot of the stuff that we talk about kind of touches on this topic, but this topic deserves its own kind of place. And including on my channel, not just at Save Our Sites. So you're only as good as your last study, unfortunately. And the site's reputation is almost synonymous with the PI's reputation. So this is true even if you have multiple PIs at your site. For example, UMass Clinical Trials, we have a respiratory specialist. That's a pulmonologist. We have a psychiatrist, we have a neurologist, we have a dermatologist, we have a cardiologist, and we have a internal medicine doctor. Now, there's different layers of reputation. So there's regulatory reputation, meaning has your PI received a warning letter? Okay, you might have five PIs and only one received a warning letter, or maybe none. In the case of UMass Clinical Trials, we don't have any warning letters. We never had a FDA audit. If we did, I doubt we would get a warning letter, but knock on wood. I mean,
You do everything you can to manage your site's reputation, indirectly manage your PI's reputation, and historians of our industry will appreciate. I believe the SMO bubble, the site management organization bubble that burst in the early 2000s, burst primarily due to a bunch of entrepreneurs ruining the reputation of a lot of principal investigators across the country. And I think ultimately that did more harm for our industry than it did good. And this time around, with the site networks, you're seeing a different, I know you like, there's rumors and there's always going to be rumors. Oh, well, we don't like site networks. We like independent sites. Well, what do you do when there's a group of independent sites that kind of share best practices, maybe not share SOPs, maybe they do, maybe don't even share branding? Like, some site networks are loosely held independent sites, whereas others are more cohesive, where they share the branding. Of the most memorable one that comes to mind today was Care Access. I believe in 2023, Care Access represented 50% of the data on a particular trial. I want to say it was a Lyme disease study, if I remember correctly, and the data was not usable. And it was because Care Access dropped the ball on a lot of things, but somehow when the FDA audited, they had no findings. So I don't know what exactly happened, but Pfizer, who was, I believe it was Pfizer, was the sponsor on that study, obviously couldn't have been a fan of Care Access, and they actually had some litigation going back and forth. I haven't followed the story, so I don't know what happens, but that's like the most, I guess, notable reputation issue that a site network has had recently or in recent memory. But in the early 2000s, when the SMO bubbles were bursting, this was all it was. It was business people going into doctors' offices, embedding themselves in there, and then just going crazy on the studies, like high enroller, high enroller, high enroller, when they didn't have a foundation. And I think that part of, like, the first step towards protecting your site's reputation is understanding that you have to build a solid foundation. And the solid foundation is training your staff properly, right? Including the PIs. And that's one of the things we try to do at Yuma Clinical Trials. And as we eventually grow into a site network, I might have some news to announce later. But at least with Yuma Clinical Trials and our five PIs that we have here, it's actually six, we've built the foundation of the coordinators. And now it's extending over into psychometric raters, and it's extending into patient recruitment, and it's extending into all kinds of other things that we're going to get into, because reputation management for a site, I believe the foundation is quality, but it's so much more than that. So quality is the most important to me, and I hope to anyone watching or listening, because all these other things we talk about, if we talk about recruitment and retention of patients, which we're going to discuss, if you don't have quality and you have really good patient recruitment, you're just going to end up being a high enroller and ruin the sponsor's study. Like, that actually happens a lot. So I think if you start with how do we not screw up a study first, as the first question you need to answer, and I even start one level higher. How do you not put patients in jeopardy? That's number one. So if you start with the end in mind, keep patients safe, give them a good experience. Number one. Number two, give good data to your sponsors. I think with those two things alone, you'll solve a lot of problems. And then you can start building on top of that framework. and on top of that foundation. So again, patient safety, number one. The data integrity, number two. Keep your PIs happy, number three. You need all those three things, and I believe in that order, in order to really have a foundation for building a good reputation for your site. And I know it sounds basic, and there's lots of videos that cover just those three topics, but it starts with, I believe, the study coordinators. They're the ones doing all the heavy lifting on the study. You've got to train them. They're the ones that are interfacing with the patients, with the sponsors, and with the PIs. They're the ones. When I started YCT, Yuma Clinical Trials, it was me. Before we hired anyone, it was me and Jaime. We had all the patient interface. We had all the sponsor interface. We had all the PI interface. Now, we've built a system. It's a lot less of me and more of my staff. And now my role has been retaining staff, training the staff, working through issues so that they don't become systemic problems. Every site's going to have issues. The key is, what do you do when you have an issue? How do you address it? So this gets into corrective action, preventative action, where a lot of people like to focus on the first two letters, the corrective action, but then they ignore the preventative action. And to me, I think they're both important. Obviously, if you made a mistake, you got to correct it. But the harder part is, how do you prevent it from happening again? And whenever we have, and especially in the early days of YCT, or in the early days of a coordinator joining, so in the within their first year, there's going to be a lot of mistakes they make. Now, it's my job to do damage control and to minimize those mistakes, but it's unavoidable that mistakes are going to happen, even on fully trained and experienced staff. But how do you use those mistakes as teaching opportunities? And whenever someone makes a mistake, I make sure all the staff know. And right now we still have a really small team. We have four full-time employees right now. We had six. One was an admin, and then the other one was a research coordinator. We're probably going to have somewhere between 4 to 8 next year. It's still small enough to where when something like this happens, like any mistake, it's a teachable moment, because you have the opportunity to explain to your staff why, first of all, why did this happen? And you're going to hear all kinds of things from the staff. And then you explain why it's important that it doesn't happen, or you should minimize these things. And more pragmatically, what to do if it does happen again. And you got to document all this stuff. So in a way, that's kind of a Kappa plan, although it's informal. We only do a formal Kappa plan when something happened on a particular study that there's a risk that it'll happen again, or it was like a significant deviation. We haven't had, I can't remember if we've done a Kappa plan. I believe we have done a couple, actually, and they were, one of them was around e-diaries, patients not following the instructions properly, and then nobody really caught it, myself included. And then another one, I don't think we had any missed consents, but we've had some inappropriately randomized patients, and those were all teachable moments. And then we also had a lot of close calls, like almost dispensing the wrong IP. Luckily, we caught those things. So these are things you got to stay on top of. Even if you've delegated a lot of the work to your staff, you as the site director, site owner, PI, lead CRC, whomever it is that's watching and listening, you need to understand that these things occur in a larger system, and ultimately somebody's responsible, and it's not the people doing the work. It's the people implementing the systems. unless those are the same people, and I don't recommend that's the case. I recommend you have someone at your site where the buck stops here, and that for now is me. Ultimately, that won't be me, but for now, it's still me. And then I vis-a-vis my lead CRC, and then she vis-a-vis the coordinators execute on this vision. And that's like this quality stuff. It's not enough to just do visits and the monitors don't find anything and then you don't worry about it anymore, which is very tempting to do. It's continuous quality improvement. I can't stress that enough. There's a lot more that goes into reputation, but not harming patients, not screwing up sponsors' data, and not pissing off PIs is a very good start. That's a very good framework. After that, there's a lot, and it boils down to employee retention, and it boils down to empowering your staff to make the decisions, like to behave autonomously, and to really empower the staff to act as you would act, as close to how you would handle a situation is what you would want them to do. So when it comes to, for example, something mundane but needs to be done on a regular basis, having a PI sign labs. Until we hire an admin to go get labs signed by PIs, it's the coordinator's job. Now, when is it too late for a PI to sign labs? A week? 3 days after you receive them? A month? I mean, you've got to let the coordinators know that you need these things signed in a timely manner. That's contemporaneous from Alcoa. So it boils down to me, the way I do it is a lot of one-on-one discussions and then a lot of team discussions too. If I'm seeing labs systematically taking longer to get signed, I address it and I say, listen, in our SOPs, it doesn't actually have a time set. It just says in a timely manner. That's done on purpose. But I tell the staff, what do you think is appropriate? Because if our visit windows are a week apart and you wait a week for a patient to, or for a PI to sign the patient's last labs, they're already on their next visit. That's not okay. So when, what do you want to do? And then we kind of come to a consensus. Well, 2 to 3 days, I think, is appropriate. But if we can, in 1 day, and if we can't get the PI in that one in 3 days, we'll have the sub-I do it. And we'll ultimately have the PI co-sign it. So you come to a, like, working through these problems as a team. I think as you start to scale, you do need to have more, I guess, rules and guidelines. But we've also moved on to where we have a primary coordinator for every study, which is something brand new that we've implemented, because up until this point, everyone was kind of sharing the load on studies and working as a group. Now we have primary coordinators being responsible for certain studies. And now I know, okay, this study's having issues, you know, our metrics. And if you can't measure it, it's not happening. You can't improve it. So who's measuring how long it's taking to get labs signed? It should be some kind of QA, quality assurance component of your site. If you don't have that person, guess what? That's you. And if you do have that, then that person needs to be doing it and needs to be keeping everyone consistent with what's appropriate for your site. So quality is the foundation of reputation. Next is your interactions with your CRA. If your CRA constantly has to harp on your site to get action items done or to send things, you know, to SIP or wherever the case may be, and you're not replying, you're making your CRA's job harder. They do get asked at the end of studies, would you recommend this site for another study? You don't want them to have to think about that one. You want them to immediately say, yes, of course. That's reputation management. And you work with your CRAs sometimes for years. So it's very important that the coordinator and the CRA have a good working relationship. And if that's not the case, it's very important that site management gets involved in order to minimize any damage done to the site's reputation. Now, everyone's favorite, patient recruitment. You can have the best quality in the world and the best interactions with your CRAs. If you're not enrolling patients, forget about reputation. You're not making money, so you're not going to have much of a reputation anyways, because businesses that shut down don't have a reputation, or they have a bad one. So you obviously need to have patients in your studies. We're building tools like Patient Ace. We're using tools like Patient Ace. Link is underneath the video and in the show notes. But it's not just like a magical tool. It's you have to dedicate someone almost full time. Like, we had an admin that was full time responding to leads. And I do think that as our site grows, we need that more and more. And right now we're like in between admins. So one of our CRCs is doing both coordinating and following up on leads. When we get an admin, that coordinator is going to still do coordinating, but she'll be in charge of the new admin. It's imperative that it's done. And I almost want to hire someone to do admin work over the weekends, because these leads need to be responded to, again, in a timely manner. You can't just sit around. If somebody clicks a link that they're interested in your depression study and they click it on Friday night, who's waiting till Monday morning? If they're lucky, a lot of these sites don't respond till like Monday afternoon or sometimes Tuesday. Hey, Monday we were busy. That's that person who clicked on that link already forgot, especially if it's depression. Even more so if it's like bipolar mania. You want to get as close to real time as you can. And that's part of reputation management when it comes to patients as well. Because if patients are clicking links and not getting back, no one's getting back to them, and then they have friends who saw the same link and they start talking, they'll say, well, nobody reached out. Or even worse, you do reach out, and your staff is rude or dismissive, which happens, believe it or not. It hasn't happened at our site, but because that's something we hire for. But it has happened at other sites. Those patients are not going to have a good experience. And that's before they even join any study, just interacting with people on the phone. Now, screen fails is another thing. There's many things as far as screen fails that can affect the site's reputation, both from the sponsor's perspective and from the patient perspective. Obviously, from the sponsor perspective, if your screen fail ratio is an outlier, let's say on a given study, the screen fail rate is 70%. That means 7 out of 10 patients that you screen do not randomize, they screen fail. If that's the average and your site's at 9 out of 10 or 90%, you're an outlier. If you maintain that metric for a significant period of time, somebody's going to talk to you from the sponsor side of things and say, why are you, why are we wasting time with you on these screen fails? And then you might even find yourself getting audited by the sponsor. Now, from the patient side, I found a very different reputation management aspect. Or component. Coordinators get busy, especially if they have a high screen fail rate. They don't always tell the patients they've screen failed, like in a timely manner. So I make it a point, as soon as you know a patient screen failed, you need to reach out to them, either by phone or text, however they preferred to receive their communication, and you need to let them know why. Of course, you document it in the progress note that they were referred back to their primary care physician, or whatever the case may be, but you let the patient know, hey, this is why. It's maybe not your fault, maybe it is, maybe it's out of your hands, but this is why. We do have other studies. These are the ones that are coming up, or these are the ones we have right now. Here's your options. It's amazing to me how many sites, and I've caught this even at my own, not with the newer staff, I don't think, but with the previous staff, where they were not letting the patients know that they screen failed until later. And patients would text me, because at that time, I still interacted with patients. And they would text me, hey, what's going on? You know, my e-diary, it won't let me log in anymore. And then I had to explain, hey, sorry, you know, they should have let you know, but it's my fault, but you were screen failed, and here's why. So that's part of our training program now, is like, you got to let the patient know they screen failed. You don't want that bad reputation from the patient, because then the perception is you don't really care. And who wants to be like excited about possibly joining a study, and then they don't even know that they don't qualify until later, or it's through some roundabout way. So now it's a point, hey, as soon as we know, you need to let the patient know. There's reputation management from that aspect. So from the sponsor's perspective, obviously they don't like high screen fail rates. They also don't like patients dropping out a lot. So you need to have work on your retention for your patients. And that's tough, especially for some of these indications. But again, if you're an outlier, and sometimes it's hard to know, well, what's the site average retention rate? What's the dropout rate? What's the screen fail rate? Going back to your interaction with your CRA, you can probably find out from your CRA. If you can't find it in the newsletter, you can find from your CRA, or you can find out from your clinical trial manager what the study metrics are. And you should care, because you will at least know where you stand. If you use something like Creo, or not even Creo, hey, we've screened 10 patients and 6 have screen failed, you know you're at a 60% screen fail ratio. It'd be nice to know what the study-wide screen fail ratio is. Same thing with retention rate, same thing with deviations. I always ask my CRAs as a site director, where do we stand when it comes with other sites? From enrollment, from a screen fail, from a deviation, from everything. Like, where do we, objectively and subjectively, where do we stand? Where do we match up with at least your sites, if it's the CRA? And oftentimes the CRA will tell me, well, I don't have the numbers study-wide, but I know from my sites, you guys are, and the last one said, really high on enrollment, and you're about average when it comes to quality, but you have been trending in the right direction in that regards too. And that was because we had a relatively newer staff and everyone's still learning. But that was good to hear and good to know. The same CRA texted me when we started approaching high enroller territory. And I told my staff, let's put a pause on screening for a few weeks, let other sites catch up. We don't want unnecessary attention on us right now. We're still a newer site. I'd rather we go slowly than go crazy. And part of that is reputation management for my PIs. I don't want my PIs, at least while they're still newer, to be worried about going through a sponsor audit or an FDA audit. If it happens, it happens. But if I can control it, I'd rather turn that lever down right now and let my PIs just get more acclimated to doing clinical research. And that's where this stuff is part science and part art. And if you're the site owner or site director or lead CRC or whomever is in charge of running that site, these are all the levers you've got to pull. So it's patients, it's sponsors, and it's your physicians that you've got to worry about with your site's reputation. Then you get into things like community awareness and branding. And I've done in this very room, like a 1-hour video with Daniel, our videographer, on creating content for the community, giving back to the community by promoting businesses without wanting anything in return. We're actually going to look at a video right now about a shrimp taco place, Mariscos. That's also reputation management. And believe it or not, that stuff, it's not just locally important for the community to get to know us. And one of the big hacks of increasing your brand awareness in your own community is interviewing business owners, because they have a brand as well. And then they share that post with their customers. And now you've kind of hacked into their customer base. Now their customers know your brand too. Like, to me, that's obvious. The bigger, the like further upstream effects of that are you're developing a good reputation among sponsors who see that stuff. Because I post every now and then, I'll post one of our good community spotlight interviews on LinkedIn, on our Yuma Clinical Trials LinkedIn page. I try not to spam that one, but I do post like some of our better interviews there. Actually, all of our monthly hour-long podcast I upload there. And every now and then sponsors take notice. And I know because we've been featured on sponsor webinars where Yuma Clinical Trials presents in front of the entire sponsored team of like 200 people live, and probably another 200 that watch it after the fact. And if that's just from shooting a podcast with, you know, a business owner once a month, to me, it's worth it. Obviously, it's worth it for the local brand awareness, but it's also worth it for the national brand awareness we're developing. Same concept with our Instagram, really. Same concept with our TikTok that we had one of our coordinators do. So that's reputation management from all these different angles. Ultimately, the goal is to keep your business flowing, to keep it to where you can scale and grow like predictable growth. Once you start getting into unpredictable growth, you're at risk of ruining reputation because the growth is getting away from the foundation. So I don't think research sites necessarily, like the actual site itself, I'm not a fan of crazy growth. I'm okay with doubling your growth every year while you're smaller. I think that's not crazy, but it's not like a tech company where you're just growing by like 100x every year. I think you're doubling every year for the first 5 years. I think that's normal. I think after that, you start growing in, again, controllable ways by expanding into different therapeutic areas or expanding into new geographic territories, like just immediately outside your region, like Brad is doing in Oklahoma. He's now going to Arkansas. I think that's controlled growth. I think we run the risk of ruining everyone's reputation by doing crazy growth like the SMOs did in the early 2000s. And I don't think the site networks are doing that. And the site networks are having rapid growth. Like these site networks, and I hope to have a lot more to say about this when I'm actually, maybe Yuma Clinical Trials is part of a site network. But I think the site networks are growing faster than a site by itself can grow. And I think that's part of the attraction of joining a site network, is you kind of have your controlled growth locally, but you're also scaling it in multiple geographic areas. But then you've got to worry about reputation when it comes to the larger brand. But there's a lot of economies of scale that come with scaling. And there's plenty more to discuss, I guess, with reputation management for site networks. But as far as a site is concerned, I think I covered most of it. Maybe I'm missing something. Former employees too. That's a big part of reputation management. You can always tell the reputation of a site based on their former employees. If you talk to a former employee of a research site or any company, but just in our research community, and they don't speak highly of that site because they have nothing to gain anymore. And sometimes you got to take it with a grain of salt. People are salty that they got laid off or whatever. They're talking bad. But if everyone's consistently saying the same thing about their former workplace, there's something there. And the opposite is true as well. If everyone's saying relatively good things about a site, or neutral at worst, I think that's a good indicator as well. So couple of things you got to look out for as a site owner, site manager, site director, whatever the case may be. Like, subscribe, comment, share. Check out the links in under the video and in the show notes. And with that being said, take care.